I think it's still so raw that he just went missing and his plane just crashed into the sea.
The atmosphere around home games certainly seems focused on football. Of course it does, but it will never be forgotten. He will never be forgotten.
It hits us hard because we make these players our heroes, and therefore we assume with our heroes that they are immortal. We assume they're going to be there forever because they have fame and money and are good at kicking the ball around, which couldn't be further from the truth.
Hello and welcome to Who Are You, the podcast about what it means to be a football fan. This episode will be a bit different from our usual club-focused approach as we explore football's relationship with tragedy. The history of football has unfortunately been littered with tragic events. But has football changed how it deals with death? Can football be a force for good in dealing with grief? Or has the media turned death into spectacle? Two events this season in English football have had us thinking about these questions. The two air disasters involving two Premier League clubs, Vichai Srivaddhanaprabha and Emiliano Sala. Two men from different corners of the globe. Their sudden, shocking deaths brought tears and tributes from far and wide. How are we as fans supposed to react when a player, manager, chairman, or in fact anyone involved with the team we love, dies? Do we truly grieve for them? Does it matter whether they played for our club or not? We are interested in these questions because we believe it's a side of football that very rarely generates much discussion. This episode contains topics that aren't particularly cheerful. So if you're after a feel-good documentary, perhaps try episode 2 of Who Are You? To Cardiff then, where last summer, Bluebirds fan Ben James was celebrating his side's promotion to the Premier League.
That final day of the season, it was just an incredible feeling when we knew we'd gone up because Fulham had failed, and it was just one of pure elation and like a pure release on the final day. I think it did feel different to the season we went up previously. I think that's mainly down to the fact that we were back in blue, the fact that we were, you know, more united as a club because Warnock had come in and everything had kind of been, not reset, I think reset is the wrong word, but things had gone back to how they used to be in terms of the kit colour and how we were feeling about the club. So I think it was, you know, I think the promotion under Malky Mackay was good, but this one was better. It was just a better feeling all around because it just felt like everyone was really rooting for it and going for it rather than having this cloud of the red kit over us.
We've discovered on previous episodes of this podcast that a promotion can generate a real buzz across a town or city, and the Welsh capital was no exception.
It was more excitement, really. I think when you know, the summer we had, we didn't spend as much as other clubs. Again, I think that's going to be, you know, that's a theme we've got, but we bolstered the squad when we needed to. And I think people were just really excited about that opening day against Bournemouth. And I think it wasn't, you know, I think in the Premier League, there's always going to be an element of being worried. And I think we, you know, we were probably nervous, but I don't think anyone was really letting that dampening their spirit because I think no one expected us to go up. Now we're in the Premier League. No one expects us to stay up. So, hey, let's just give it a go.
As many teams before Cardiff have found, competing in the Premier League is a difficult and expensive business. Neil Warnock's side had struggled to break out of the relegation dogfight, and so decided a big money move was required in the January transfer window. An Argentinian striker, plying his trade in France's Ligue 1, came to the attention of Cardiff fans.
The one thing we needed really was an out-and-out striker. So then there was rumours that we were looking at this guy called Salah from Nantes. Obviously, you don't know much about him. You know, the French league isn't well covered, but you start looking into him and you see that his record is better than Mbappe, better than Neymar in France, that he's scoring basically week in, week out. And you think, okay, maybe he's a good bet. But then you also temper your expectations. I think, honestly, I don't think when we started looking at him, I don't think any fan thought that it was going to come off because we knew we'd have to spend 18 to 20 million pounds. And as a club, we've never done that. The chase for him kind of went up and down. There was a time when he'd agreed terms, then he hadn't agreed terms. We'd agreed a fee, but the player wanted more money. There was all manner of things were being said, and it just never looked like it was going to come off in the end. And then, you know, it got to the end of the month and somehow they pulled it out of the bag.
Salah was Cardiff's record signing at a reported 15 million pounds. He'd scored 12 goals in 19 games this season for Nantes. Cardiff fans were looking forward to seeing if this could be the man to turn their fortunes around. The deal was done. Salah had completed a medical and posed for pictures holding the club's shirt. Having gone back to France to say farewell to his teammates, Salah set off to Cardiff on the 21st of January to start his new job.
This is the story of Emiliano Salah, a footballer from rural Argentina, days away from achieving his dream of playing in the Premier League. His death has placed an intense focus on the often tawdry business of professional football.
It's a really sort of numbing feeling that you just, you don't really know how to, you know, you're just refreshing for news, basically. My first tweet was, I don't really know what to say about this, but all I can do is hope for the best outcome in this situation. I think that was probably quite a good summation of the general feeling of fans. I think no one really knew what to expect. Twitter was just awash with this kind of, you know, it was almost like a zombie-like feeling that people were just kind of lurching from one thing to the next and not really knowing and not really getting any further information, really, because it took a couple of days for everything to really become clear as to what had happened.
As Ben came to terms with the news, it was clear to see that his sensitivity to this difficult situation wasn't mirrored in some corners of the media and the online football community. The Daily Star reported, and we say this with heavy inverted commas, hashtag Emiliano Sala Ultimate Team card soar in price as hashtag Cardiff City striker goes missing. If you don't know what that means, I wouldn't blame you. But what it meant was that the Daily Star were capitalising on Salah's disappearance by linking it to a popular video game to generate clicks and shares. Football writer and broadcaster Daniel Story was incensed. "This is absolutely ghoulish," he tweeted. "A man might have died. That has to be more important than hashtags and content." We spoke to Daniel about how incidents such as Salah's are treated by a media thirsty for your attention.
I think we've got a general problem, not just in this country and not just in sports journalism, but in kind of in general, that social media allows people to push stuff out very quickly without actually adding the filter of whether you should put something out. It's a very easy thing to do. Personally, I think that tweet is incredibly disrespectful. I think that the fact that is going on in FIFA is something, but people would not, you know, the vast majority of people would not know about that if the Daily Star hadn't run a story and tweeted out that story. I think there has to be a sense of decency with journalism. There has to be standards that are upheld that says if we are in a position of authority, and any newspaper and their Twitter account is, we have to uphold our standards to a level that is generally considered and reasonably considered to be decent. And I don't think tweeting about the effect on a computer game of a player potentially dying in a plane crash is particularly decent. I understand that, the pretty instant retort of, well, if you don't like it, just ignore it. And I get that. But if we take a step back, there's no need for everything to be news. Not everything has to be a story. Not everything has to be hashtag content. We can take a step back and not make everything a story. We can choose to not publish certain things. You know, there is an argument that those media outlets only do those stories because people click on them, and therefore if people click on them, there's an interest, and they can argue a kind of supply and demand thing here. But again, I go back to the idea that there has to be standards upheld in journalism. There has to be a sense that we're holding ourselves account to something a little bit higher than just what will people click on.
Whilst the majority of the Salah coverage avoided clickbait and was fairly reported on by talented journalists, the fact that the Daily Star thought the tragedy's effect on a video game was newsworthy may tell us something. It tells us that there is a curious, morbid appetite for some to find out whatever details they can about a story, and about how football stories can sometimes worm their way into real human stories. It's as if sections of the football media take Bill Shankly's famous quote a bit too literally. "Some people think football is a matter of life and death. I assure you, it's much more serious than that." As the days passed, more and more stories broke with details of the crash. There was a grim, eerie voice recording from Salah himself, and the continued search effort to find the wreckage, and then, eventually, pictures of the wrecked plane still containing Salah's body. A man who had never kicked a ball in the Premier League was now one of its most well-known players. You could almost be forgiven for forgetting there was another man still missing, Salah's pilot, David Ibbotson. At time of writing, his body hasn't been found.
There's an appetite now for the real harrowing details that, you know, just knowing that something happened isn't enough. And I think if you look at the two most recent kind of football tragedies that have been in the public eye, the Leicester one and then the Emiliano Sala. And if you look at the Leicester one, I remember going on, you know, all manner of the Mirror, Daily Mail, and they had the video of the plane taking off and then spiraling out of control. And it's kind of like, we don't need to see that, really. And I that's how I felt about Salah. You know, this is, he's a human at the bottom of it all. And yes, he was a Cardiff player, and yes, he might have been a Nantes player, but you don't need to know that, and you don't need to be able to listen to the voicemail message that he sent when he was clearly very scared, and you know, on the way to the, you know, to, you know, the plane crashing or whatever happened to it. And then I think when in more recent days, when they've kind of found the plane now, the fact that the plane was kind of the image of the plane at the seabed was splashed all across, and not even with a kind of trigger warning, if you will, because I think that's quite a harrowing piece of content to see a plane at the bottom of the sea, and the reports were that there was a body in there and all that kind of stuff. And you just think, we know what's happened. We don't really need to know the intimate details of things, because that there's some things that should be left private. And that's just, you know, that's my view on it, really, that I don't think we don't need to know everything, and we don't need to be able to see into the last moments of someone's life to know that a tragic accident has happened.
Salah left behind a grieving family, but he also left behind fans, fellow players, and the game as a whole. It's common when our sport faces tragedy to describe football as a family. Indeed, hashtag football family is often a hashtag in Twitter tributes. There's also an online culture of needing to declare your club allegiance when paying tribute to anyone associated with the opposition. Underneath a Cardiff City tweet about Salah, you'll find tweets such as RIP from a Leeds fan, rest in peace from a Swansea fan, and so on. Why do we do this? Surely club allegiance is the last thing that matters in grief. I suppose it's a sense of underlining football's universality. The loss of a footballer is a loss for football. We'll leave it up to you to form your own opinion on these partisan tributes. But Cardiff City fans in particular were faced with a perplexing situation when it came to Salah. Could they miss a player who never played a minute for them? Could their grief be genuine?
It's incredibly difficult, and it's the impossible question and the impossible kind of moral conundrum, in that there will be a huge number of Cardiff fans, I'm sure, thinking that's really annoying because he was going to be a good player for us, and I really love my football team and I want them to stay in the Premier League, and he quite simply could have been the difference between us doing that and not, and now we're not going to have him. And that feels, you know, the reaction to that feels incredibly selfish, and obviously it is incredibly selfish. We have to look beyond football and appreciate a very tragic loss of life for a very young man, and two very young men, including the pilot, who has kind of been, alluding to what you're saying, has kind of been, you know, brushed under the carpet here. But I do get it, because, you know, Cardiff fans are excited about that player, and he's not going to be joining them anymore. It feels very selfish to focus on that element, and I'm sure the vast majority of Cardiff fans can do both. I'm pretty sure they can say, look, this is incredibly tragic, this is awful, I hope the club does something to mark this. But also it leaves us in a very sticky situation.
Ben can make sense of the fact that Salah will never play for Cardiff, but the human side of the story is tougher to handle.
He's never going to play for Cardiff City. We spent, you know, we chased him down, we signed him, we brought him across in this kind of fanfare, and he was going to be our season saviour. But in reality, you know, he's never going to play for Cardiff, and that's what I can deal with. But I can't, I'm still struggling with the whole, with everything else, really, because it's just, I think it's just so, so sad. And I think it's still so raw that he just went missing and his plane just crashed into the sea. And I think there was a time when we were trying, you know, the transfer window was still open, and this is where the football comes in. The transfer window was still open, and there were a lot of people on Twitter saying, oh, why aren't we signing anyone? And it was kind of like, well, because the worst thing in the world has just happened, in a sense that we signed someone who is probably the saviour of our season, and he literally died on the way to the football club. And I just don't know if there was ever that period of real reflection from, you know, I think we've had the tributes at the ground and things like that, but I think this is something that goes beyond just the football. It's going to impact the club for a long time to come, and it's going to impact the people involved forever. You try and sum it up in football, and you see everyone kind of, all these other fans from people like Swansea saying, you know, rivalries aside and that kind of thing. But then at the bottom of it all, and at the base of this is the human. It's Emiliano Salah. He's, you know, he's got his family, he's got friends who are impacts, he's got his teammates, you know, he's got you know, he's had the best season of his life and he's meant to be travelling off to find a new job in a new country and, you know, set up his you know, next stage of his career, and all of a sudden that's completely taken away from him. And I think you start reading the kind of real detail of what he felt on the plane, and, you know, that his family was seen on TV, and, you know, they're trying to get answers and that kind of thing. And you kind of, you know, we're not his family and we're not his friends, but we were his, you know, his next destination, his next stage in his career. And you start almost living through the motions with them, because you hear those, you know, I couldn't bring myself to listen to them because, you know, I found it all a bit too much. But, you know, you could hear the voice notes he sent his family and friends saying about the plane falling apart, and you start getting the detail of how scared he must have been. And it's, you know, it's just a horrible, horrible tragedy that, you know, affected, you know, just, it could have been any of us, really. Do you know what I mean?
For Ben and other Cardiff fans, there is almost an awkwardness to their grief for Salah. He never kicked a ball for the club. He hadn't been a hero on the pitch. But that doesn't mean they weren't allowed to grieve. The situation in South Wales, however, was a very different one to the situation in Leicester a few months prior. On 27th of October 2018, Leicester owner Vishay Shriver Dhanaprabha died in a helicopter crash at the Foxes King Power Stadium. For a game that has become plagued by the stories of unscrupulous owners, Kun Vishay was the embodiment of a dream. His investment and enthusiasm made him popular with his staff and supporters. Best known around the world for financing the most unlikely story in English football history, Leicester City's Premier League title win in 2016. Ian Stringer, BBC football commentator and Leicester City fan, quite understandably, is reverential in describing what the Thai businessman achieved.
Kun Vishay led the football club quietly, unassuming, a diminutive character, but he just oozed authority. Everywhere he went, he just had this authority about him. And he led Leicester City to a day that we didn't even dream of. You know, we'd go into a toy shop as Foxes fans, and we'd look to the top shelf as young children. The greatest toy right on the top shelf on its own, glistening, that you couldn't even reach with a ladder if you tried. You just look up and see this incredible toy in this toy shop. It was the FA Cup. And we'd try as kids and stand on our tiptoes and dream one day we're going to get that toy in that toy shop. It's going to be the best day ever. Kun Vishay put us in the lift in that toy shop, and he took us up to a different level, the penthouse, and took us into a room where there was a different toy that we didn't even know existed. And it was the league title. It was to be the best of the best. There will never be a more incredible sports story of achievement ever.
Vishay was a man who created a dream and allowed his football club to achieve something that so many thought was simply impossible, which made that night especially hard for the people of Leicester.
It was a strange kickoff time because of it was a televised game on a Saturday. Leicester City played West Ham, and we went off the air quite quickly, actually, at 8 o'clock. I took my colleague, as we normally would, packed up our kit. The helicopter had landed while we were on the air, but it hadn't taken off while we were on the air, which actually sometimes it did. Anyway, we packed up our kit, got on the road, and I'd just dropped my colleague off at the newsroom, and I was in my car driving home, and my phone started ringing lots and lots, and answered a couple of calls, and because obviously I didn't have access to any social media or anything, I was on the road, and turned my car around and didn't go home for the next 3 days. I hadn't legislated for the level of emotion that was to then come. It was almost like the wave was drawing back into the sea before it then kind of crashed over the top, and then the scale of what happened could be witnessed and could be seen. That kind of came later. It was the flowers. It was the flowers outside the stadium the next day. So I was actually on the air on Radio Leicester in the radio car outside the stadium, and there was a father holding his son. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning and the tributes had started. I was there when there were three bouquets of flowers and a large picture of Ganesh, a Hindu god. And as people started to arrive, I remember seeing a father holding his son on his left hip. And his son was probably about the same age as Oliver, my son, kind of blonde hair in a side parting, nice, neat shoes, and his dad had him on his hip. And his dad had hold of some yellow flowers. And I remember seeing this little boy be put down on the floor. And his dad gave him the flowers. And this little boy, three-year-old boy, in 2018, you know, he'll probably have been born in 2015, just before the greatest season in his football club's history was about to unfold. And the man who made that happen had gone, and he didn't know this, but he grabbed these flowers from his dad and he slowly plodded up to what was turning into a shrine for Cwm Vishai. And he put the flowers down gently and he walked back to his dad. And it was that moment that I realised the emotion from my city that I call home was just pouring out onto the streets of the King Power Stadium.
It's only natural that the news agenda moves on. Other stories happen and need to be told. But still, Ian is reminded of Cwm Vishai every home game when he takes a look over his right shoulder.
The thing that sticks out for the first home game, which was Burnley at home, and they'd had the walk for Vishai, and some of the players had walked the mile from the city centre to the stadium. And I remember looking behind me. So if I look over my right shoulder, their executive box is right there. It's 10 rows behind me over my right shoulder. And I remember checking my shoulder for that Burnley game and nobody was in there. Kuntop, his son, was down in his seat in the director's box. But the most stark thing was the empty seat next to him. And there's nobody in that seat. And I don't think there'll ever be anybody sitting in that seat. Somebody said to me when I was in Thailand at the funeral, somebody from within the football club said to me, the boss will have wanted the show to go on and he will have understood and wanted the players and the club to crack on and try and keep going with the football. And in many respects, they've done that. Of course they have. And the atmosphere around home games certainly seems focused on football. Of course it does, but it will never be forgotten. He will never be forgotten.
In Brazil, now 2.5 years since a plane crash killed 71 people, including the majority of the Chapecoense squad, Thiago Rebelo explains how life had to keep moving.
Heartbreaker. The first 2 weeks, no football. I think was the same feeling for everyone. But now the life is going on. Right? The life needs to be lived. And so it's a new way to survive. Because the tragedy is not a tragedy for 71 people. It's a tragedy for thousands.
Chapecoense were on their way to a Copa Sudamerica final when the plane crashed and brought an end to their dream.
For Brazilian, Chapecoense now is the second team of everyone. When Chapecoense becoming a new city, for example, to play against Vasco, Botafogo, Flamengo, Grêmio, Inter, people have a consideration of Chapecoense. People normally don't say bad things against players of Chapecoense. So in the first year was more dramatic. Now it's getting normal, but everyone have many consideration about the new team of Chapecoense, because it's not normal a small club like Chapecoense become so many years in the first division of Brazil. Chapecoense lost everything. Chapecoense was living the best moment of his life, and so it's hard to imagine a small city like Chapecó in the middle of Santa Catarina. It's very, very far from the capital, Florianópolis. It's very far from São Paulo, is the biggest city in Brazil. But the club went to a final of Copa Sul-Americana. It's unbelievable to think a small club that 3-4 years ago was playing the third national division and now is playing international competition. And so it's unbelievable. But for a crime, Chapecoense lost his dream. And so I think this that's the point that Chapecoense is the second team of all of Brazilians. When Chapecoense hire a new player, the new player knows what's going on in a new club. That's the Chapecoense of the final game of Sul-Americana, the Chapecoense that lost 71 lives in a disaster, in a crime. And so there is a feeling for everyone that plays in Chapecoense. That's beautiful. I think it's the same with the Manchester in 60 decades after the flight disaster. And for everyone that to get the new t-shirt of Manchester knows, now I'm playing Manchester. That's a new club. That's a club that's rebuilding after disaster. I need to play more. I need to show more brave. I think it's the same feeling about clubs in the past that lost his life, that had a disaster. It needs to rebuild in everything.
All these stories happen to be air disasters, but they highlight our feelings for the game in the harshest light. We don't fall in love with athletes and footballers and imagine them losing their lives. And combine that with the hero worship we have for the players and others who are involved in the game, a death can prove a real shock to the system. Recently we lost the great Gordon Banks, and football supporters all around the world expressed their sadness. Although his death was not as sudden as the lives of Salah or Koen Vichai, it was nonetheless a shock for football to lose a giant of the game. It felt especially real for us as Stoke City supporters to lose a club legend, even though his career ended long before we were born. For Daniel Storey, a mourning for our football heroes is rooted in exactly the fact that, for us, they are heroes.
Footballers, to us, feel like working class heroes, I think, traditionally. And one of the reasons I think that football for so long has dealt very badly with mental health issues is that a sad part of working class culture was this kind of stiff upper lip mentality that men had to be men, and that meant not crying and not talking about your feelings. And of course, that's, complete nonsense. And I think how we react to deaths probably comes from a very similar place in that it hits us hard because we make these players our heroes, and therefore we assume with our heroes that they are immortal. We assume they're going to be there forever, and we also assume that they are somehow immune to the rigors of everyday life because they have fame and money and are good at kicking a ball around, which is couldn't be further from the truth. So yes, I think we do. I think it's our own fault. I think we too often forget that footballers are human, that sports stars are human, that they are no different to you and I other than their ability to be good at a particular sport. And therefore, when they do suffer, not just when they pass away, but when they fall from grace and when they, when they fail to toe the line, when they suffer mentally, I think we always have to take a step back and realise, oh, goodness, yeah, of course they do, because they're the same as us. My only hope is that, their deaths, that their travails, that we can somehow take strength from them and learn lessons from them and pass on those lessons to the next generation, because it would be a huge shame if in 20 years time we were still having conversations saying, oh goodness, did you know that footballer had mental health issues or had depression, because no one ever talked about it because he was afraid to. So I hope that changes. But yes, footballers will always hold a special place in my heart because it's the thing I care most about in life outside of, friends and family. So they will always hit me hard and they always catch you off guard because we are hardwired into the Saturday 3 p.m., Tuesday, Wednesday night routine of football. We're transfixed by transfer window culture. We are not transfixed by the personal lives of footballers and their mental health travail. So when they happen, I think it really catches us off guard.
Back in Leicester, does Ian Stringer see how the city can recover?
I don't know what recovery looks like for the city, for the football club. The football club's doing what it can. Of course, it's picking itself up and standing up, and the players are performing and performing admirably and excellently at times. And the manager and the senior staff of the football club. I don't know what recovery looks like for the football club on the pitch, but tragedy of this nature is almost unprecedented. And when unprecedented incidents occur, I think that people need to be afforded latitude to deal with them as they see fit. If one person wants to deal with it in one way and another person the opposite way, that's okay. That's, you know, these things are difficult. So I think people need to deal with the loss as best they can, but also appreciate that others will deal with it in different ways. The context of what football is needs to be firm in people's minds. It is football, but there's a family without a father.
And as everyone involved with Cardiff and Nantes still struggles with the tragedy, Ben feels like he views football in a different light following Emiliano Sala's premature passing.
At the moment, I would say yes. I think I help run a Cardiff City website. I run a quite prominent Cardiff City Twitter account, and I don't have the appetite to engage with it as much as I used to. My issue is all of the kind of crap that comes with it, really. You see people on Twitter kind of moving on and saying, we need to sign a player, we need to do this, we need to do that. I just think all of that stuff is really put into perspective by stuff, you know, by the disappearance and the demise of Emiliano Sala, because it's just kind of, it just doesn't really matter. It just doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. And yeah, we'll stay up, we'll go down, and I'll still go to the games and all that kind of stuff. But I just think I don't have the appetite for all of the speculation and the stuff that comes with it, really. I've been to so many games where there's been a minute silence for a player who's been and gone, or there was a minute silence for a fan who, you know, passed away on the way to the ground, or you know, something like that. You know, all tragic events, but those are almost kind of, they're rare, they happen to someone else and that kind of thing. I just don't think I've ever really, you don't really process it, do you, at the time? You kind of, or you stand there and go, oh yeah, it's really sad that someone who's 80 has died, or someone who used to play for the club has died, and you kind of don't ever confront it. You just kind of process it while you're there. Well, this has kind of been an all-consuming kind of thing, really.
Tragedy has changed the very nature of following football in Great Britain. After Heysel and Hillsborough came new regulation and a new kind of match day, which for better and worse means that the fixture you go to next weekend is likely to be very different to one 30 years ago. Now, though, football's relationship with death and tragedy has become a spectacle in itself. We'll never stop loving football, and our reactions to tragedy underline precisely how much we love it. It's why a Welsh city can lay tributes to an Argentinian who never played for their club. Why one corner of the West Midlands wept for a Thai billionaire. Why people adopted a relatively unknown Brazilian side as one of their clubs, and why the passing of an 81-year-old in Stoke-on-Trent can send shockwaves across the world. Thank you for listening to this episode of Who Are You? If you enjoyed it, please leave a review on iTunes. We love to read what you think about our episodes. If you have any feedback, questions, or want to suggest a club we cover in future, you can tweet us at WhoAreYouPod or email whoareyoupodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for everyone who helped us create this episode. Thank you to Daniel Story, Ian Stringer, Ben James, and Thiago Ribello. The interviews were conducted by myself, Ben Cartwright, and the script was a co-production between myself and David Cowlishaw. Thanks again for listening. See you soon.